The third case for oral argument this morning is Behrens versus Wedmore. For the appellant, Behrens is Michael Marlowe, an attorney from Yankton, and for the appellee is Daniel F. Duffy, an attorney from Rapid City. Justice Conan Camp has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, a former justice of this court, to sit in his place. Mr. Marlowe, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning, counsel, members of the court, Justice Miller. Before I get started, I'd like to introduce my client, Don Behrens. He's in the court today. drove from Rapid City to view the arguments. I think it's important in this case to start with a bit of background. It's a somewhat factually complex case. I'm going to try to give you just a bit of background to help you wind your way through things as the arguments proceed. Behrens Mortuary was a family-owned business for literally generations in the Black Hills area, and specifically in Rapid City. At the time of its sale in 1997, it was the second largest funeral home in the state of South Dakota. By the mid-1990s, significant consolidation was occurring in the funeral home industry, and there were essentially two large players and multiple, two multinational players and multiple regional players trying to consolidate funeral homes such as the Behrens Funeral Home. They began to receive unsolicited inquiries from a company called Lowen, a company called SCI, and other companies. In fact, in 1996, they received an unsolicited offer from Lowen literally in the mail to pay them $2 million for their business. The offer piqued some curiosity from the Behrens. They didn't have any members of their family that were going to be interested in continuing the tradition, and they knew that they would have to sell sooner or later. They spoke with the Lowen folks, and Mr. Don Behrens went to Florida to discuss a possible sale and learn more about the company. And when he returned from Florida, without ever making a counteroffer to this $2 million proposal from Behrens, from Lowen, Lowen doubled the offer to $4.1 million. The Behrens then discussed further with Lowen the potential for a sale, and eventually arrived at a potential sale price of $4.55 million. Shortly after that, Lowen submitted to the Behrens a letter of intent for them to sign. They did sign that document. It's undisputed. The only parties to this document were Lowen and the Behrens. It's undisputed from the Behrens' testimony that the day that document was signed, the letter of intent, the Behrens were told by the representative of Lowen that they could tear up the document if it did not suit the needs their needs after they discussed it with their attorney. Another critical point in the case is that SCI, after they had learned that Behrens had received this letter of intent from Lowen, SCI came back to Behrens and said, whatever their best deal is, we'll better it. About 2 days after the letter of intent was signed, the Behrens met with their attorney, Mr. Wedmore. They had an approximately 90-minute meeting to discuss the terms of the letter of intent. Mr. Wedmore's practice was to keep notes during meetings such as this. None, however, were produced in this case, and apparently none were located by Mr. Wedmore. Mr. Don Behrens testified at trial that immediately upon reviewing the letter of intent, Mr. Wedmore said, aha, it expires in 90 days. There's some terms in here I don't like. We'll simply let it expire, and then we'll write our own deal. I understand that Mr. Wedmore denied that at trial, but the first note, the very first note that appears in his file is a very brief entry. He is apparently talking with one of the Lowen attorneys, and he makes two points. First thing he did was state the letter of the date of the letter of intent. The second one was he calculated 90 days which was the expiration date, and wrote that down. I'll go into more specifics on the letter of intent and the ultimate sale documents as necessary during the argument. The validity of the letter of intent in this case is absolutely critical. The case turned on this document, when in fact it should have been nothing more than a footnote to the case. This court has repeatedly said that the validity of a contract is a question of law. As a matter of fact, Mr. Wedmore and his counsel and Mr. Behrens and their counsel agreed that that was the case. That is the law in this case. In fact, both of us moved for summary judgment on that basis, and for some reason, the trial court denied both motions and submitted that issue. The validity of a contract was submitted to the jury.
Wasn't that, or couldn't that have been submitted to the jury because of the dispute you just mentioned about whether they were going to agree to let the letter expire, or whether they were going to be bound by that?
The discussions between Behrens and their counsel had nothing to do with the conduct of the parties, the intent of the parties in negotiating the letter of intent to begin with. That was between Lowens and Behrens. Whatever was meant between those two individuals, the contracting parties, if you will, or the agreeing parties, was actually what the court should have been looking at. Whether it expired or not could have been an issue for later determination, but the fact of the matter is the court was asked to determine, but failed to determine, the legal issue of whether a contract was formed by the letter of intent. This court in the Jarrett's case in 1999 said whether a contract is formed is judged objectively by the conduct of the parties. What did the parties do in this case? They executed a letter of intent that they were told could be torn up. That's undisputed. Nobody else was there except the Behrens and the loan representative. They could tear it up. They signed a letter of intent that by its own terms, and I'm quoting the word contemplated from the document, by its own terms contemplated a further transaction. The contemplated transaction was $2.55 million down and a $2 million unsecured note without interest. Furthermore, the letter of intent indicated that while the transaction was being contemplated, the Behrens could not negotiate to sell those assets to someone else. If they had a deal, why were they prevented from negotiating to sell to someone else? In fact, the letter of intent was contingent upon a number of things that made it an illusory contract. Initially, due diligence was required by Lowen. Secondly, it was contingent upon Lowen obtaining finances satisfactory to Lowen. It was contingent upon Lowen entering into an agreement with Don and John's parents, who didn't sign the letter of intent. Don and John's parents owned what Mr. Wedmore called the crown jewel in this transaction. They owned the funeral home building. They didn't sign the letter of intent. How could they be forced to sell that property? They couldn't. That's why Lowen required a separate agreement with them, which was again in contemplation of completing the sale. Lowen also stipulated that they must get employment contracts with key employees. And perhaps the most important and the most telling thing that proves that this is not a contract is that it was never approved by Lowen. Lowen is a corporation. It can only act through its board of directors. The specific requirement, a precondition for the agreement, was approval by Lowen's board of directors. Lowen's board of directors did not approve this letter of intent. How could it be a contract if the contracting party, Lowen, did not have approval to enter into a contract? It's a classic agreement to agree, gentlemen, and that is not, and Judge Meyer-Henry, and that is not a contract. The letter of intent also required a closing within 90 days. That would have been on July 15th, 1997. There was a provision for a 30-day extension to Lowen for very specific, narrow exceptions. Now, after the letter of intent was signed, again, we're supposed to look at the conduct of the parties. What did they do then? After it was signed, Wedmore immediately said to his Lowen counterparts that he had the right to make changes. The parties began negotiating and negotiated for 2.5 months. They exchanged perhaps 20 drafts of documents, of the sale documents. The buyer changed. It changed from an unsecured note to a note secured by a mortgage. We added a contract for deed. We added 8.5% interest to the note that was supposed to be unsecured and without interest. By the way, that would have added, if not for the bankruptcy, that would have added about $200,000 in payments to the transaction. We added cross-default language that was supposed to tie these two properties together, that so in the event of default, these folks would get the properties back. Of course, that didn't happen. And we added a lease back to Don for one part of the buildings in question. Does that sound like a letter of intent, formed the contract for these parties? I think not. And in fact, Mr. Wedmore said not. 2 months after the contracts were executed, the sale documents were executed, Lowen came back and said, oh, by the way, we weren't supposed to have interest on that note. That's what the letter of intent says, and we want you to execute new notes. The Lowen representative sent a letter to Don and John Behrens to that effect. Don and John brought the letter to Wedmore, and Wedmore called John Sada, his counterpart, and that is documented in Exhibit 48, Mr. Wedmore's own handwriting. At the top of the note on the telephone call, it says, "You must be kidding. You think the letter of intent is valid? You must be kidding." And he went on to enumerate why the letter of intent wasn't valid. It was renegotiated over 2 months. They changed the buyer. The buildings were not owned by the parties. That is, the building that was sold supposedly by this letter of intent wasn't even owned by the people that signed the letter of intent. So how in the world could the letter of intent be a contract? Does that sound like the argument that I just made? Sure it is. In addition to that, Mr. Wedmore goes on to say that the interest was necessary to make the deal go, because Don and John's parents wouldn't have sold the building without the inclusion of interest. Does it sound like they had a contract to sell that building under the letter of intent? Look at the conduct of the parties, gentlemen. That's what this court has directed the trial court to do. That's what the trial court did not do in this case. Ultimately, when Mr. Wedmore made those arguments to Lowen's counsel agreed and said, "You're right. The letter of intent is not valid." I mentioned it before, but during those arguments, he said, not only is it not valid, but it was allowed to expire by the parties. Mr. Wedmore made that argument in his own handwriting in Exhibit 48 when he talked to that lawyer. He even circled it. LOI expired. And in fact, as a matter of law, the letter of intent did expire in this case. Wedmore agrees in his sworn testimony at trial transcript 413, that the letter of intent expired on July 15th of 1997, absent extension by Lowen for those very narrow reasons having to do with due diligence. On July 16th then, and it's exhibit number 37, Mr. Wedmore faxed a letter to his opposing counsel confirming that there were no reasons to extend the contract. No reasons. Then Mr. Wedmore began to negotiate in earnest. It was only after July 15th that he asked for and received a mortgage, that he asked for and received a contract for deed, cross-default provisions, and interest on the note. In short, after July 15th, he was free to negotiate a new deal, just like he promised his client the first time they met. The problem is, when he negotiated that new deal, he didn't get the security necessary to protect his clients in bankruptcy. Now, why is the validity and the court's ruling on this letter of intent so critical? Because when he submitted the issue of the validity of the letter of intent to the jury, that allowed Mr. Wedmore and his attorneys to blame Barron's for what happened in bankruptcy. That was an error of law and without a doubt was highly prejudicial. The error was then compounded by the erroneous instruction on contributory negligence and assumption of the risk. Absent non-disclosure, ignoring advice, or violating instructions, contributory negligence is simply not an appropriate defense in a professional liability case. We've cited a bunch of cases in our briefs, but perhaps the Utah Supreme Court in 2000 in a case called Steiner Corporation set it out best. And I hesitate to quote during oral arguments, but I couldn't say it any better. A pre-existing condition that a professional is called upon to resolve cannot be the cause, either proximate or direct, of the professional's failure to exercise an appropriate standard of care in fulfilling his duties. To decide otherwise would allow professionals to avoid responsibility for the very duties they undertake to perform. The Steiner Court went on to quote an excellent example of why that can't be the law. The court stated, a doctor, for example, might be able to avoid liability for negligently treating an injured person because the patient negligently ran a traffic light and was injured. Finally, the court stated, such a result would be clearly unsound. The appropriate inquiry for the jury in this case and in any professional liability case is simple. When faced with these circumstances, what would an attorney using the care and skill ordinarily exercised in like cases do? If Mr. Wedmore erroneously drafted documents, it cannot be a defense that his clients brought him documents that were somehow defective to begin with.
Was this a general verdict, or were there special interrogatories in the verdict so that you know whether or not the jury actually considered the contributory negligence?
It was a general verdict form, is my understanding. Another important point, I think, on the instructions is the instruction on assumption of the risk. It was prejudicial and error as a matter of law. Assumption of the risk presupposes that the plaintiff recognizes and understands the possible risks created by the tortfeasor's pre-existing negligence. The slippery sidewalk case, the construction site case. You recognize that the negligence has occurred, that the danger exists, and you go forward with that recognition. How can the Barons be charged with recognizing and understanding the risks created by Wedmore's negligence? They are not lawyers. He didn't even understand the risks created by his negligence. Assumption of the risk was clearly an improper instruction in this case. In addition to the errors committed in instructing the jury and in failing to rule that the letter of intent was invalid as a matter of law, the court also erred by admitting the Cadel Thorson appraisal. The appraisal was offered for admission through the testimony of Don Barons. No one from Cadel Thorson was ever called as a witness. The Cadel Thorson appraisal was offered to Mr. Barons, and I objected on foundation. Mr. Barons was asked if he could identify the document. He could not. He asked if he'd ever seen the document prior to suit. He could not say. In fact, Mr. Duffy told the court that the document should be discoverable because it was produced in discovery by Mr. Barons. Obviously, discoverable does not equal admissible. And I think in their briefs, they recognize that. They recognize the court made an error. And they try to say, well, it's a business record. And it falls under the business record exception to the hearsay rule. Couple of problems. It wasn't a business record of Barron's mortuary.
You know, though, on that point, as I read something, I forgot where it was, it seemed to me that the interrogatory that was involved, didn't Mr. Barron's expressly incorporate that document as his opinion of the value of the business?
No.
Was that in response?
No, not at all. What they asked was if we had any appraisals that were done. And we said there were. We expect to have a recent appraisal. There was one done in the past, and we produced a draft copy of the document that wasn't the same document that was produced at trial, that was represented to the court as being something that we did produce. It was a Cadle Thorson record. It was not a record kept by the Barons. Even if that's the case, Judge, even Justice, even if that's the case, in order to be a business record, it has to be a business record of the person producing the document. My client did not produce the document. My client didn't even know if he had seen that document before the suit.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Duffy, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to give a little bit of additional background information, but I think it's important, Justice Zinter, to respond, since it's on the forefront of my thinking right now, your question regarding the appraisal. The question wasn't, please produce appraisals. The sworn interrogatory question was, please state the present day value of the property, buildings, and the mortuary business. That's why the appraisal came into evidence, because if Mr. Barron's had simply written out the same information under answer as a sworn interrogatory, to the sworn interrogatory, there isn't any question. But what he did was he simply incorporated that document and attached it to the interrogatory answers and said, this is the present day value of the mortuary business.
Well, then tell me, what about the argument that it's not the same document that was produced in discovery? Or did I misunderstand?
No, that's an argument that has been made by appellant's counsel. But if you look at the transcript, at the time that Mr. Barron's was on the witness stand and was cross-examined with that interrogatory answer and shown that exhibit, that's the answer that he gave. It is the same document. One was produced by Mr. Barron's, another was produced by Cadle Thorsonson, but it's the same document. I'd like to give a little bit of additional background, because I think we spent probably 12 or 13 or 14 minutes discussing the April 16th agreement. And I think that it's important that I make one thing very clear. That April 16th agreement and its validity is absolutely irrelevant to our case. And that was made clear to Judge Gores at the beginning of the trial, and it was made clear to the jurors, and it was made clear in our brief. Whether or not that April 16th agreement is a valid enforceable contract, and we believe it is, but it was only relevant because pre-trial we made a motion for summary judgment saying under Weiss versus Van Norben and Stab versus Cameron that if that is a valid and enforceable contract, then as a matter of law, the case should be dismissed. Our summary judgment motion was predicated purely on the issue of proximate cause as it arose out of those two Supreme Court decisions. It had nothing to do with what, once we got to trial, and this point is very clear in the transcript, once we got to trial, it was not my position, it was not my client's position, and it certainly wasn't my expert's position, that any of our defenses in this case rose and fell on whether or not that April 16th agreement was valid or not. It simply became another piece of evidence. And the reason that that's critical is if you look at the testimony of Doug Hayak and Brent Wilbur, both of them said that when you look at that document, it's a five or six page agreement that contains arguably all of the essential elements of an enforceable contract under South Dakota law. Steve Sanford on cross-examination admitted the same thing, that yes, it arguably was a contract. It was our position that a reasonable and prudent lawyer, after his clients have negotiated for 5 or 6 months without contacting him and have gone through at least 3 iterations of that agreement, and in the documents that the court has as part of this record, the Barons themselves made it clear to Lowen that we need to talk to our financial and our legal advisors before we proceed any further. The Barons continue to negotiate the terms of the sale of their business. Started in December of 96, they at one point said to Lowen, now we know that this might expire, but we don't want it to, so will you give us additional time so that we can meet with the people we need to talk to? They then went into, and I believe the date is March 18th, Lowen came back then with 2 additional offers, you know, pick one or the other. On March 25th, and again, this is a document that's in the record and that was seen by the jury. On March 25th, the Barons wrote back without ever contacting Mr. Wedmore, without ever talking to a lawyer, they wrote back and said, okay, here's what we want. We want $2.55 million in cash, and X amount will be attributed to the purchase of the mortuary building. We want a $2 million, no interest, unsecured promissory note. And they put in parens, we want the unsecured promissory note to be defined. On March 25th, they sent that to the Loewen Corporation. Paul Haar, on behalf of Loewen, sent back an April 16th agreement that mirrored every term that they asked for. Every term. And on cross-examination, both Donald and John Barron said, we would not have gone forward if we didn't have unsecured promissory note defined for us. And both of them conceded that at trial. So at the time that they signed that April 16th agreement, they got all the terms they asked for, they negotiated for exactly what they wanted, they had all of their questions answered by Loewen in terms of concerns that they may have had about an unsecured promissory note, and they went forward with the deal. The reason that was, we believe it's valid, again, but what's important about that is once they came to Mr. Wedmore on April 18th, 2 days later, there's nothing in this record that says that the Barons ever said to Mr. Wedmore, we don't want to do this deal. We want to tear this thing up and throw it away. The jury heard those arguments, and the jury rejected them. There's nothing in the record in terms of documentary evidence other than the claims by the Barons that they wanted anything more except to close this deal absolutely as quickly as they could. And that's why the April 16th agreement was important to us, because what it said was, and this is what our expert said, if you were a reasonable and prudent lawyer and your client comes in and gives you a document that says that you are selling your business for arguably twice what it's worth, and they lay that in front of you, and you have a cash down payment of $2.5 million, which by itself is arguably more than the entire business is worth, your job as a lawyer is not to interfere in that deal. If there was evidence to suggest that the Barons wanted him to, it might be a different story. But there's nothing in this record that the Barons ever told Mel Wedmore, we don't want to go through with this deal. They always wanted to close this deal. In fact, the one common theme that ran through this entire case and this entire trial was, don't jeopardize that $2.5 million down payment. Whatever you do, do not jeopardize the $2.5 million down payment. That's why the April 16th agreement is important. Whether the jury decided that it was a valid contract, if the jury decided that it was valid, or if the court decided that it was valid, then the case should be dismissed. Because that means any proximate cause is related to what the Barons elected to do and not anything that Mel Wedmore did. And that's the only reason that it was significant. But my argument, and this is in the transcript, my argument to the jury was, folks, you can look at this April 16th agreement, whether it's valid or invalid, we believe it's valid. But our argument is this was a deal that was made by the client, and the client never told the lawyer to change it, and the client went through for the next 2.5 to 3 months, and at no time is there anything in the record where the Barons ever said, stop, we want to tear this up, stop, we don't want an unsecured promissory note, stop, we don't understand what we're doing. In fact, at all times, both Donald and John Barons admitted Mel Wedmore was available to talk to us about this deal anytime we wanted. The record shows 55, I believe, between 50 and 60 meetings from April 18th until July 24th.
Wouldn't there be an obligation on the part of the attorney at that point to at least point out to the clients the alternative or maybe even the necessity of getting some security in the event of a bankruptcy?
The experts who testified in this case said bankruptcy is such an amorphous, unpredictable place that it's hard to tell your client what's going to happen. What Mel Wedmore did do, and this again, the Barons disputed, but it's in the record. Mel Wedmore, when he met with the Barons, said, you have a $2 million unsecured promissory note. You've got a heck of a good deal here, but you do know that there's a risk that you may not get paid. The Barons, on cross-examination, admitted that they weren't the slightest bit concerned about bankruptcy. In fact, the question was put to them, in fact, Mr. Barons, if someone told you they thought the Loewen Corporation was a bankruptcy risk, you would have thought that they'd lost their mind. And both of them agreed, yes, we weren't the slightest bit concerned about Loewen being a bankruptcy risk. So in response to your question, Justice Sabres,
So even though they are not concerned about it, isn't there a duty on the part of the attorney to point out that possibility as an alternative?
I guess you're asking me, and I guess what I would do is point to the testimony that came in from the experts who testified, Brent Wilbur and I believe Rich Huffman probably addressed this issue. Both of them said, no, you're, when you're, and I think the law, even in the restatement says this, when you're retained to represent the client, are there things that maybe you could do or should do? Maybe, but the question really is the failure to do something outside the standard of care for you as a lawyer? And I think the testimony that came in from Brent Wilbur and from Rich Huffman was, you can talk to your clients about a number of things, but the standard of care in this situation certainly didn't require Mel Wedmore to go through a discussion of what might happen in bankruptcy. That was their opinion. The jury heard that. The jury heard the opposite from Steve Sanford, and I think they accepted that what can happen in bankruptcy is so difficult to define.
Isn't bankruptcy, I mean, they use the term amorphous or something, but to me, it seemed like the term should be, it's so prevalent. You look at Enron, you look at Northwestern, the various airlines. I mean, it seems to me it's so prevalent that there would be a duty to point out the possibility or the alternative of that happening, and then what type of security measures are involved.
And again, all I can say, Justice Sabres, I guess two things really, because I think what you're saying goes to one of the comments that I made in the opening statement in the trial. First, I think there was a dispute between the experts about whether that was a requirement. And I think because in a case like this, we're all lawyers, so we're all thinking about, well, you know, what should you do or not do? But at least at trial, there was a debate between the experts on whether that was required or not. But I think you do hit on a point that I think we can't separate ourselves from, and that is this happened in 1996 and 1997. And one of the things that I said in the opening statement is, you know, the whole corporate world changed incredibly in the next 4 or 5 years. You talk about Enron, you talk about the 4 or 5 now, what are the largest bankruptcies in history, have occurred since about 1999 and 2000. At the time that this bankruptcy occurred, when Loewen went into bankruptcy, it was among the top 2 or 3 largest bankruptcies in history. So I agree, but I think we were dealing back then. Everybody was moving fast. There was a lot of money being thrown around at these mortuary companies, and I don't think there's any dispute that these companies were overpaying for them. But the projections were that everybody was going to keep riding high. And so I think at that point in time, the Barons, that was not within their frame of thinking that the bankruptcy was a possibility. In fact, I think it's in the record that after closing, Donald Barons bought $50,000 worth of Loewen stock.
Isn't it the lawyer's duty to point out things that's not in the client's thinking or range of thinking?
I think there may be circumstances or situations where that is true. I think when you look at the restatement, I think that the general rule is that a lawyer is obligated to do that which his client retains him to do, and to perform those duties that the client retains him to perform. And I think that's what's important in this case, is when the Barons came to Mel Wedmore on April 18th, there was a projected June 30th closing date. There was never a request. All they said was, this is the deal. You're going to get some closing documents. We want to get this thing closed. So there really wasn't any question by the client at that point that there was even a concern of non-payment. And quite frankly, prior to April 16th, they testified they had all of their concerns about the unsecured promissory note answered. So I understand, Justice Sabres, it's difficult because as lawyers we're thinking, well, in retrospect, you know, should we talk to them about these things that ultimately occur? I think there's a question. I do. I think it's there's a dispute. In any situation, it might be different in a transactional setting as to what a lawyer may or may not be obligated to talk to their client about. And I think that dispute in this case was resolved because we did have lawyers, I'll say very good lawyers on both sides, who had differences of opinion about whether Mel Wedmore met the standard of care in his dealings with the Barons. And I think the jury resolved that in favor of believing that he did meet the standard of care in this case.
Was there any kind of engagement letter at all?
No, there wasn't an engagement letter, Justice Sinter, because they had been clients between George and Harry Barons, the two fathers who Mel Wedmore started with back in 35 years earlier, and then with Donald and John. He had been doing all of their work for over 3 decades. So I think all along the way when Mr. Barons did legal work for them, it was as part of an ongoing representation that he had of both Donald and John and of Barons Mortuary Inc. So there wasn't an engagement letter. One of the issues that was raised relating to you know, the letter of intent is the issue of the affirmative defenses of contributory negligence and assumption of the risk. And I think Justice Meyer-Henry hit on it. I believe that as a general rule that the law is fairly clear in the cases that these are appropriate affirmative defenses in professional liability cases. But in this case, Justice Meyer-Henry, with a general verdict form, and when you read Knutson versus Hess and the other cases that this court has decided, that there is so much evidence in this case to support the notion that not only did Mel Wedmore not commit malpractice, he did his clients a tremendous service by getting them over $1 million in additional security paid out of the bankruptcy that, at least according to the record, no one that we know of out of 800 or 900 mortuaries received that kind of payment and that kind of security. So I agree with a general verdict form. I believe there are appropriate affirmative defenses, but with a general verdict form, I think there was so much evidence to support a finding by the jury that there was no malpractice that I don't think that it was prejudicial, even if the court elected not to allow those instructions to go to the jury.
On assumption of the risk, how could the Barons have knowingly assumed the risks of bankruptcy as lay people?
They didn't assume the risks of bankruptcy, because I think we're narrowing it down now to what ultimately occurred. What they assumed was the risk of non-payment. Non-payment can come in the form of a default, of a client who has no money. There didn't have to be a bankruptcy for the Barons not to get paid. There could be any of a number of reasons. And the evidence that the jury heard was that Mel Wedmore told Don and John Barons, you may not get paid. That's the first. But if we go back prior to that, the Barons both testified that they sent a letter to Lowen saying, define unsecured promissory note for us. Both of them agreed that they would not have signed the April 16th agreement if they had not had those questions regarding an unsecured promissory note answered. So when you look at the elements of assumption of the risk, it's a little bit like it's hard because you can't have it both ways. You can't enter an agreement and negotiate all the essential terms of the agreement, have all of your questions answered, and have an unsecured promissory note, and have it go forward, and then have the results of that produce for them a partial non-payment. You can't, on the one hand, say, we didn't assume any risk, and then at the same time say, and plus what we did wasn't binding. It wasn't valid or enforceable in terms of proximate cause. So I think if the case is going to go forward to the jury as it did, that their own conduct has to be woven into how we got to July 24th and the terms and conditions that were a part of the ultimate closing of this case. And I've only got about 4 minutes time left, but I would like... Justice.
Tell me about this. I may have missed it, but where is the explanation of what an unsecured note is? In response to their question about define it. Is there a letter or something that came along?
No, there was a letter that was sent out on March 25th from the Barons to Lowen in response to their March 18th offers. And the March 18th offers contained an unsecured promissory note as one of the components of payment. On March 25th, Barons wrote back and said, we really want to sell the whole business, but we would like to sell the whole package together, and here's what we would like to do. $2.55 million in cash, $2 million by virtue of an unsecured no-interest promissory note. And in Barons, it said unsecured promissory note to be defined. Well, you go from March 25th to April 16th, and the April 16th document says $2 million unsecured promissory note. So you go from their question about defining it to them signing in a document that contains an unsecured promissory note. So I asked them on cross-examination, did you have all of your questions answered regarding the unsecured promissory note? And they said, well, we must have or we wouldn't have signed the agreement. So there's no document coming back, but there's their own admission that they asked for it, they signed it, and they must have had their questions answered, and they conceded they did. In the brief time that I have left, I guess the two questions that I would like to address are just the notice of review issues, unless the court has any other questions. This case should not have gone to the jury on the claim of legal malpractice. If you look at our court's decisions regarding establishing a case within a case, and if you look at the recent decision by the California Supreme Court in Viner versus Sweet, the jury, when they went back to the deliberation room, was left to do nothing more than completely speculate about whether this deal could have ever been other than what it was. Robert Eastgate, the Lowen representative, testified he had no idea if there was additional security that could have ever been available. He testified that there were 800 or 900 creditor mortuaries, that there was a $750 million line of credit, and that it was the standard procedure for Lowen to go out and buy these mortuaries and pledge all of those assets back to the lending institutions. Brent Wilbur testified as well. He reviewed the bankruptcy documents and said what they're proposing in this case isn't really legally possible, because the assets that would have formed the basis for this cross-collateralization couldn't have happened. No one came back in rebuttal and said, no, you're wrong, it was possible. So what we're left with is a jury under our court's case law that goes back and says, you're saying we should have done all these things, stack mortgages, pledge non-real estate assets back to secure the promissory note, and then go into bankruptcy with a creditor's bid. But the jury had absolutely no evidence, nothing, that would have ever told them that that was ever possible coming from Loewing. Not even a reasonable assumption that it might have been. So, and then the other side of the Viner versus Sweet argument is, well, but if you'd have told us, we wouldn't have gone through. If you'd have told us about the risks of bankruptcy, we wouldn't have gone through with the deal. This court has said a party can never escape their own, the admissions made in their own testimony. In the transcript, you will see on cross-examination of both Donald and John, they both admitted we had no concerns about Loewing going into bankruptcy. I mean, they admitted it. If someone had told you that Loewing might be a bankruptcy risk, you would have thought they were crazy, wouldn't you? What was their answer? Yes. So all the talking in the world as a matter of law that Mel Wedmore could have done about bankruptcy would have fallen on deaf ears, because they have admitted that they were not the slightest bit concerned that this company was going to go into bankruptcy. And they admitted as much. So on both sides, either number one, they said they wouldn't have gone through with the deal. There's no evidence to support that. And on the flip side of it, this whole transaction that they used as part of their case as to how you could have gotten more damages, first it was rejected by the jury. But more importantly, at a directed verdict stage, there was no evidence to support that deal was ever even possible. I have 5 seconds left. There was no expert on attorney's fees, and I believe there should have been a directed verdict on that issue as well.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy.
I have one question, Chief, if it's all right.
All right.
What? Tell me about breach of fiduciary duty. Why? It seems to me that it would be a breach of fiduciary duty not to to change a fee arrangement during the course of a representation.
Well,
I don't understand why the court didn't grant the jury an instruction on that. After all, the court did grant an instruction on the reasonableness of the fee.
Right, and I guess, and I'll try to make it as brief as I can. Every element of a lawyer's relationship with his client does not give rise to a breach of fiduciary duty. In fact, there's a case that's cited in plaintiff's own brief, and I'll just give you the citation to it. Metrick versus Chats, 639 Northeast 2nd, 198. And I think that the reason this is important is I don't think there's any dispute that lawyers have a global fiduciary relationship with their client. But every component of that relationship does not give rise to a breach of fiduciary duty. Otherwise, fiduciary duty instructions would have gone to the jury in this case for Mel Wedmore not getting adequate security. So there has to be something more than negligence by a lawyer to give rise to, it has to be dishonesty, a breach of the trust, or something like that. We didn't have that in this case. All we had was a bill that was given to the client, as it has always been in the past. The client looked at it and said, is this correct? Mr. Wedmore said, yes, it is. It was 1% or less of the transaction. Within a day, they paid it.
Go ahead, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy. Mr. Marlowe, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. How about the violation of an ethical duty? Ethical canon. Would that support a breach of fiduciary duty instruction? Certainly it should. Can anyone doubt that you are in a fiduciary basis with your client when you're writing them a bill?
But having said that, you know, there's a jury instruction that just lays out point by point how to determine the reasonableness of a fee. So what difference does it make which legal theory the court or the jury was instructed on if they were allowed to determine the reasonableness of the fee?
Because, Justice Sinter, the trial court didn't understand and Mr. Duffy didn't understand, this is not a reasonableness of a fee claim. I need not provide an expert to testify as to the reasonableness of Mr. Wedmore's fees. He established that by conduct with his client over 35 years. At the same time he was working on this deal, the sale of this mortuary, he did other work for the clients and charged them $95 an hour. The ethical code, as this court knows, requires that an attorney, if it's a new client, you gotta tell him the fees. If it is an existing client, you can't change the fee agreement without telling them at the beginning of the work or shortly thereafter. They're hooked on this one. Mr. Duffy in his brief says, well, we told them. We told them before it was done. They told the Barons, after the bill was submitted, and after Mr. Barons says, is this right? That's when they were told it's a 1% deal. They had never, ever, in 35 years, been billed on a 1% deal before. They hadn't been billed on a 1% deal for other work he was doing at the same time.
But what's your remedy?
The remedy is...
What different remedy is available for breach of fiduciary duty than what's already instructed?
I don't have to meet the burden of negligence. The whole burden is different. If they are in a fiduciary capacity with my client when he bills, look at the Dorothy case. You folks set out the standard when you are dealing with the fiduciary duty.
Well, you're
I don't have to show negligence. I don't have to show an expert witness that sets forth what the appropriate fee should have been. He already set the fee.
So you're suggesting that the attorney can recover nothing if there's a breach of fiduciary duty?
No, I'm suggesting that there are cases out there that say that he is entitled to nothing. If you breach your fiduciary duty, change the deal in violation of your ethics, yes, a court can say you're not entitled to anything.
Isn't he entitled to the $95 an hour he ordinarily charged?
Sure. That would be the logical conclusion, depending on the circumstances. If it is so egregious and so unfair, doubling your fee, at the time he sent him the bill, he had 209 hours. He charged them $42,000. That's a couple hundred bucks an hour. That's better than double what he had ever charged these people before. And when he asked, he said, oh, no, that's standard. You can't do that. And Chief Justice, perhaps that is the right remedy. Give him 95 bucks an hour. That was the real deal. That was the agreement he had with his clients, not whether the fee was reasonable. That has no bearing.
Apparently your clients thought 95 bucks an hour was reasonable for previous work because they never complained about it, right?
I agree.
Okay.
But that's not what was charged in this case. What was charged in this case at the time he submitted the bill was over $200 an hour. And he didn't disclose that to them. That's what really gets me fired up about this case. You can't change the rules after you do the work.
Did he have a lot more hours after the 209 at the time he billed?
You know, there is a tape that was in the records that says something about 330. The tape was done contemporaneously with the submission of the bill. So I don't know how he came up with this other 330 hours. He has 209 hours documented. He has 0 hours documented after that time. He did some work, not much, not 120 hours worth of work afterward. And even if he did, if he's going to charge them based on fees, you've got to have records. You can't just throw it out there. Look what he did on the expenses also. He didn't document any expenses. He said, a couple $1,000 will cover the expenses. You don't bill your clients $2,000 without telling them how you got to those expenses.
Now you did argue that to the jury, though, right?
Yes, Judge, I did. But I didn't have the ability to go back and say, you know, when you're billing your clients, you owe them a fiduciary responsibility to do what is in their best interest. That was taken away from me. You know, I thought that was kind of an agreed deal when I looked at the briefs. In Mr. Barron's brief, they seem to agree that it's a fiduciary duty and it's a fiduciary responsibility. They cite authority that say that you can really bring it under three different theories. So for the court to have directed a verdict on that case, even if it could also support a negligence claim or breach of contract claim, the court, I mean, the plaintiff can pick your own cause of action. In a products case, I can claim a warranty, breach of warranty or a contract or a strict products liability. If I have the elements, I get the instruction. We should have gotten a directed verdict on that, and we certainly should have gotten an instruction on that basis. I wanted to just cover a couple of other things. The appraisal issue, it is not the same document. Look at our reply brief. That's why we provided both documents to you. It is not the same document. Our version says draft all over it. Their version has a cover sheet that was never provided to us.
Is there any material distinction in the value of the business? Between these two documents, there's a dispute about.
I think the, no, I think that the basically the guts of it are the same.
So what prejudice would there be if it's not the same document?
Because it's hearsay, they didn't prove a business records exception. It is not our business record. If it is a business record and applies, and an exception applies, they have to call the person who drafted the document, whose business record it is. Call Kittle Thorstensen, and then you establish the elements necessary. You then establish that it was relevant. How in the world was that document relevant to issues in this case? The value of the business was what a willing buyer paid a willing seller, and in essence, that's what that document says, except at that time, Lowen had told him, well, it probably would be worth a couple million bucks. The unsolicited offer that they then doubled without a reply from my clients. See, Mr. Duffy argued it even here today. He argued the same thing to the jury. Mr. Wedmore did a great job. He got him arguably twice what it was worth. What does the value of this business have to do with whether Mr. Wedmore committed professional negligence?
Well, now, you read from that Utah case earlier, but then Mr. Duffy reminded me of a case from this court that I'd forgotten about, Staub versus Cameron, that basically, under my understanding, holds that if a client brings in an attorney, says, here's the agreement, implement it, the client's stuck with it, as long as the attorney implements it in accordance with the client's structure. Now, are you asking us to overturn that?
No, this is not the same case.
Why isn't it?
Because the agreement was not enforceable. And Mr. Wedmore had the duty to recognize that it was not enforceable, had the duty to recognize that it had severe consequences for his clients, and had the duty to tell his clients the risks and then negotiate, because it was not a binding agreement, negotiate for a better deal. They weren't going to lose this deal. SCI was out there willing to pay him more than what the Lowen offer was. Lowen came to these folks unsolicited, and then they doubled their offer. They were dying to get this place. It was the best one available in South Dakota for sale. We talked a little bit about the bankruptcy issues and whether he should advise him of the risk and things. You know what? My clients weren't concerned about bankruptcy because Mr. Wedmore told them that in bankruptcy, that would trigger a default, and the default would trigger two things happening: immediate payment, or that they would get their buildings back and be able to keep their money that they'd been paid. He didn't tell them that out loud. He told them that in the documents that he negligently drafted. Those documents contain strict foreclosure language that this court says is not enforceable and has said that for dozens of years, and bankruptcy says is absolutely on its face unenforceable. But when Don and John Barron sat there and read line for line with Mr. Wedmore, and those documents said in the event of default, which also was defined as bankruptcy, what is going to happen to us? You are either going to get paid immediately in full, or immediately you get the buildings back and you get to keep what's been paid to you.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.